Blog Talk Radio.
You know, every day I get news from around the world. A lot of the readers on the Facebook page send me articles, quotes, things like that. And just this morning I got an article from a gentleman who lives in Italy. And the article he sent me is fascinating because the title of the article is Atlantis, Legendary Metal Found in Shipwreck. And, you know, I've had a personal interest in ancient history for 30-plus years, probably even longer than that. I'd say since I was 10. And the thing that just blows my mind is I believe that those of us who live in America are seeing a lot of things through a filter. And what does that mean? Well, if you've been listening to the program, you know that we've reported on the Smithsonian, the National Geographic, a number of other university research centers, kind of giving us bits and pieces of what they've discovered or what they've uncovered, and in some cases, actually covering information up. We know this from people like Richard Dewhurst, who wrote a book on the giants. From big time, we hear from people like Michael Cremo, who's written numerous books on the massive cover-up of ancient documents, artifacts, even skeletal remains, which kind of blows my mind that they would want to keep those hidden. But I guess if it's something that's anomalous, doesn't fit into the patterns that they've set up, then they got to hide it. But anyhow, this morning I got an article on a group of researchers who were diving, and off the coast of Greece, they discovered these metal objects. They look like coins, but they're not. And apparently Plato wrote about them. They're called orichalcum, and orichalcum. Orichalcum, and it is said to have come from Atlantis. And Plato talks about it, as well as a few other chroniclers of early prehistory, as a metal that came from a very sophisticated country, and that being Atlantis. And the picture I posted shows the dive team that found these trinkets, and I'm going to get some more photographs that are not published of the actual artifacts. Now, if it turns out to be true, nothing will validate Atlantis more. I mean, other than obviously the ruins, and we've had archaeologists like Bill Donato tell us and show us photographs of what he's found off the Bimini Islands, which are pyramids, pyramidal structures, and huge complexes. Now, we're waiting for him to go back and take photographs with Greg Little, but until that time, these kinds of discoveries, metalworks and unusual ore, it just validates the lost land of Atlantis. And so go to the Facebook page, Earth Ancients, and take a look at this article. And it's amazing. It goes into quite a bit of detail. The Sicily's Sea Office, the Discovery Group, is the one who found it in about 1,000 feet of water off the coast of Greece. So take a look at that. The other thing, we had Robert Bevall on the program before. Robert Bevall continues to push the envelope about antiquity and ancient Egypt. And he posted a small article on the inventory stele, or the inventory stone controversy. And in 1858, the French archaeologist Mariette found this stone that actually tells the story of Khufu making repairs to the Sphinx. Now, Khufu is noted for being the builder of the Great Pyramid. And this is kind of one of those things where here's an actual document saying that he was doing repairs on the Sphinx, and the Sphinx is somewhat dated to be the same age as the Great Pyramid. Well, this kind of all leads us to wonder, why is modern Egyptologist rejecting this stone? And apparently they don't consider this a true archive. So take a look at that. It's a very interesting article that he wrote, the inventory stele, and it's an actual picture of it that very few people get to look at, apparently. So that's a piece of evidence that really throws the controversy or the history of the Giza pyramid into question. The last thing I'm going to talk about, and I've been posting quite a bit on the Gunung Penang pyramid, but they continue to discover strange artifacts that are made out of stone, which are seem to be imbued with some crystal-like material or minerals. And the most recent discovery is of this stone that one of the researchers considers a weapon of some kind. And in the article that's posted on Earth Ancient's Facebook page, the scans reveal that it's either a tool or a weapon composed of unusual mineral deposits that one researcher says must be man-made. And the reason he says it must be man-made is that the composition that they can see under an electron microscope and also certain penetrating research instruments is a mineral-like deposit that isn't naturally shaped. It seems to be hardened artificially, which would make it man-made. And I'm really looking forward to having Danny Hillman, who is the lead geologist and the excavator of this site, Gunung Penang, on the show, because we need to know what's going on. I mean, he reported about a month ago that they had discovered a fifth area, a fifth level with rooms, and they carbon dated it to be over 20,000 years old. And when you hear something like that, that throws the scientific community into a they get very upset about that, because if we can show a sophisticated civilization at 20,000 years old. Well, that kind of throws the hunter-gatherer out the wind. It throws a lot of historic notions out the door, and makes us have to reconsider our history. So those are a few things that I want to talk about, and I am talking about right now. And, I mean, please, keep an eye on the Facebook page, because each day I am posting more information. Next week I have a guest who's going to be speaking on Nuevo Albergares, which is a place in Chile. She claims it could be a southern outpost that might have been part of Mu or Lemuria. We can only see parts of it from the sky and from satellites, but the level of sophistication, the level of composition and structural engineering that went into these buildings, and by the way, this is a very recent discovery, the last 5 years or so, and no serious archaeological team has been down to the area to to actually do any kind of excavation. So next week I'll have a guest speaking about this place who's actually an archaeologist who's been there and will tell us a little more about it. So keep an eye on Facebook, Earth Ancients, and remember, it's Earth Ancients, startling new discoveries from our planet's distant past. Okay, so today we're bringing on two people, Sasha and Janet Lesson, to speak about the Anunnaki. And I've been fascinated with Anunnaki for a number of years. As many of you know, I was the former program director for Whole Life Expo. And in 1995 through 1989, I was privileged to feature people like Zachariah Sitchin on the program, as well as a number of other people. And Zach and I became quite good friends. And when the 12th Planet came out in 1976, not only did it startle a lot of people, it shook the foundations of historic notions about mankind. Sitchin went on to write a number of books, The War of Gods and Men, The Lost Realms, and then The Cosmic Code, as well as a number of other programs. And at the time, no one was writing about his work because it was so groundbreaking. It was so phenomenal that it left not only the scientific community, but those in the ancient civilization research areas pretty much startled. People like Neil Freer would follow up Sitchin's work with a book called Breaking the God Spell, and I actually had Neil at a program. And basically, Neil's work supports Zachariah Sitchin's work and actually complements it in many ways. But when I had Zach at the expo, he had standing room only, and he would show slides of evidence. But unfortunately, he passed away in 2010, and really, there hasn't been anyone else to pick up the banner, to pick up the research, other than a few people here and there. Now, we've spoken with Michael Tellinger, and a few weeks ago, Michael was speaking to us about his most recent book, Temples of the African Gods, and if you all remember, he was also speaking quite a bit about his first book, which is The Slave Species of the God, which is based on the Anunnaki, and what they left in his estimation in South Africa. Now, Sasha Lesson has been involved with the Sitchin notion and the Anunnaki research for a long time, and I would consider him and his wife Janet to be probably the most detailed in their research and update following Sitchin's passing. And they are coming to us today from Hawaii. So let's bring them on. Hi, Janet and Sasha. How are you?
Hi. Hi, Cliff.
Hello.
Hear us.
Great to have you on the program.
Great to be here.
Now, you've been publishing. You've been publishing Enki Speaks for the last few years, right? And what was Enki Speaks? Excuse me. What was the motivation for developing this website? Because it's huge.
Well, Zachariah had asked me. Are you still there?
Yeah, I can hear you. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Here, go ahead.
Zachariah had asked me if I would develop a college-level kind of understanding where any kind of person that was interested would just look at the material and get the message of what he was saying. And so that's what I do. I write things for college student-level people, and an intelligent 12-year-old can understand what I write. And I've taken this complex material that Zachariah had, and then I thought, you know what? Why should I wait for the standard college kind of thing? I'll just make it for free for everybody who was interested in this material. And I started doing this website, and that's how it developed. And I've gone so far. What Zachariah Sitchin did was he got what the Sumerian said, that the Sky people, the Anunnaki, told him about stuff, and it makes so much sense once you understand all this stuff, and it makes specific predictions about what you're going to find in outer space and underneath the Earth and all kinds of things like that. And now, since Zachariah has died, we've gone way further to understand the history of Earth. And the Anunnaki is just part of an ongoing kind of a thing that you mentioned earlier about Atlantis. This is exactly the kind of story that humanity continually, after the last ice age, all the civilizations that were along the coast got drowned, and people went around trying to reestablish civilizations, and they made megalithic monuments all over that where they could get the energy of the earth going. They had this whole thing. That's what the Sumerians said, going back to that article you were saying about the Great Pyramid. The Sumerians said that the gods had made this great big pyramid, and it was this energy thing, and it had weapons in it and all kinds of things. But one of the main things that it did, it was on a fault line and got the electromagnetic energy of the Earth, and they pumped it on water, and the water then was pumped upward in an electromagnetic kind of a pulse, and from there it was added to a hydrogen explosion caused by zinc plus HCl and other crystals, and up it goes and out, and that was their energy system, and that's how they that's part of what they did. They used these things.
Right.
And so forth. You know.
So you have a PhD in anthropology from UCLA.
Right.
When did you begin to really take in the Sitchin material, and what led you to contact him and begin to work with him? I guess basically, what was your relationship with him, other than him asking you to do some writing?
Oh, I was just first it was the intellectual thought. There were all these things that anthropology just wasn't making any sense. There was things that absolutely, how in the world could these early South American Indians have been there before people were supposed to cross over the Bering Straits, and this whole idea of evolution, they were never finding any missing links. It all didn't make sense. So Sitchin had the intellectual answer to the O parts for the stuff that didn't fit, because he allowed me and others like me to totally break through this set that everything had to be evolutionary. Macroevolution is false. It just isn't what happened. Earth was seeded by people that were seeding it on purpose. And the Anunnaki were just one of several.
I just want to give a little history. I moved in with Dr. Liss in 1997, and I had a book called The Gods of Eden, and I put it on the back of the toilet for his reading in the bathroom. And he came out one day, and he goes, "What's this?" And he said, "Is there more?" And I said, "Yes." Yeah. So we went down to Borders. We bought all the Sitchin books that we could find and ordered the rest. Also at that time, this is late 90s, we had friends that were running the Prophet Conference, and that was Cody and Robin Johnson.
And Janet, can you talk right into the receiver, because it sounds really good. And when you move your head away, I can't hear you. So go ahead.
Okay. So we have friends named Cody and Robin Johnson, and they said that we have this fellow, Zechariah Sitchin. I go, "Oh, I know Sitchin." Well, they're doing the first certification program. So because we knew Cody and Robin Johnson, who ran the Prophets Conference, we were there for the very first certification program. And that was, I think, in 97, 98, I've lost track of time. So we started going to all the, there's a bunch of Sitchinites, and we went to all the conferences until the very end when he started just doing two-hour things in New York. I couldn't afford to fly for two-hour things. And we followed him and went to all the things we could, and totally immersed ourselves in material. So at that time, Dr. Lesson wanted to create a website, and Enki was gone already, so we got Enki Speaks, and that was probably around 99. But Dr. Lesson's been obsessed with the material ever since he discovered it, because, like he said, it was the best explanation for all the mysteries that he had when he was going, you know, through his program for being an anthropologist back in the 60s. And so, you know, it was very exciting for him. And then I've been studying extraterrestrials. I'm an experiencer. I was born in 1954. I've had experiences going back to the crib, but I started studying von Daniken and Balakowski back in the 60s, and then when Sitchin came around in the 70s. So I've been studying this all my life. But Dr. Lesson put a twist to this like no others, because he's, you know, he's a genius for one thing, and he's highly trained in anthropology. So I'll give it back to you, Sash, but he just takes this material to a whole other level.
So, Sasha, tell us, what was the motivation for Anunnaki Gods No More? Obviously, the site's been up since 1999. What compelled you to write the book?
Yes, that's, I wish to free the world from the virus of organized religions that based on a bunch of things that have been twisted about our true history. And obey me or I'll kill you and kill everybody else guys are just like, they weren't guys, they were just, when you study, I don't know if my machine's
big people that had big technology, and they had a system that sucked. It was hierarchic and warlike and violent. And made this hybrid adaptation of their genome, that's us, our genetic makers hoped that we would do better than them. That's 300,000 years ago. And then they found us so attractive that 200,000 years ago, they kept breeding a line that they liked best, and it's descendants of those people that rule the world today. And that's why it's important about these Anunnaki.
Okay, Sasha, we're losing you a little bit. You're fading on us.
I don't know what
you're saying.
Hello?
You there, Sash?
She had fixed it.
Okay, I'm going to go fix it. Hold on.
Okay, so you wanted to basically create the book to refine Sitchin's message and provide the reader with more in-depth information regarding the Sitchin philosophy for mankind.
Okay, we're back. I'm sorry, something happened with his phone, but we're going to be on.
Okay.
So sit beside me, honey, and we'll continue.
We didn't hear that.
Okay.
Okay. So, what was your next question?
So I was just saying that the book, the motivation behind the book was to take the material that Sitchin had written and refine it to the point where it was even more explanatory on his theories and what he believed through his research that the Anunnaki accomplished on Earth.
I would say that that was the start of it, but I think that there was some implicit things that I, because of my studies, have been able to add to it, which gives a whole different picture about a worldwide picture and not a picture that's limited in it. We've learned so much since then, and it's important to add Sitchin's material to the rest of the material that's coming in from serious researchers in this field.
So this is a series of books. Anunnaki Gods No More was the first one. We have Anunnaki Legacy of the Gods. And the third one is Anunnaki False Gods, which is at the editors right now. So that'll be out in about a month once we get done with the editing and formatting process.
Okay.
And the idea is for humanity to take back its responsibility for itself and stop looking to these big people in the sky and start taking care of ourselves.
Okay, so let's talk about the book, Anunnaki Gods No More. In the first part, you describe the reason for the Anunnaki coming to Earth as, and Sitchin talks about it too, to mine gold to help the Nibiru from, I don't know, either decay, orbit or whatever. So what other evidence have you found on that for their coming? Can you clarify that a little more for us?
Sure. So the way this works is the story they tell isn't directly amenable to evidence, but it leaves some implications that even if their explanation is wrong, it works. For example, they said their spaceships landed on Mars and there was water there. Okay, at the time that the Sumerians wrote that sort of stuff down, that these great big guys told them, that no one knew there was water on Mars. And they told them about, when we were flying here, we saw these planets, Neptune and Uranus. And, well, people down here couldn't see that far without telescopes. And so there's a bunch of stuff like that. But the explanations that they give about it, there's absolutely no way the way scientists like me look at things, there's no way you can tell whether the explanation, the anthropomorphized planets and stars, like they could talk and think and stuff like that. But it predicts the data. It says what you're going to find on the satellites. It said that Ceres, this planetoid that they're just seeing now, an asteroid, had water. And it has water, they said, because their ancient planet crashed into ours, and it knocked pieces of it out into the asteroid belt. And if that's true, then the asteroid would have water on it, just like Earth, and the same minerals, too. And anyway, the whole thing that's really nice about what the Anunnaki story is that it gives you explanations that make sense. For example, you were mentioning about Atlantis, which was the home of Enki, their chief scientist. And when that blew, one of the times they said that Nibiru was coming in, their planet was coming in. We don't know whether it's true that they really needed the gold for their planet or not. All we know is that's what the Sumerians said that the Anunnaki told them.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
You brought up something that, and you have it in your book, that I find interesting, that it is not mentioned in any of Sitchin's books, and that is the region known as Cydonia, which has the face on Mars, and we've had people on the show here, Mike Berra specifically, say that there's a tremendous amount of man-made structures, and there's an underground city and so forth and so on.
Oh, yeah.
What evidence do you show that is an Anunnaki base, and that that was a rest place or something that was used by the Anunnaki?
Sure. So again, we don't know the stories are right, but it does predict what they said is they had banished their ex-king, Alalu, to die on Mars. And the medical corps, led by the king's daughter, Nimma, came there, and he had died. This Alalu's ex-king had died, but his companion, Anzu, was revived. And then Anzu and Nimma blasted this with their processes of moving megalithic stones, and I'm not going to go into all that, but they made this huge statue at Cydonia, which was supposedly of Alalu with his eagle's helmet pulled back so you could see his face, because he had saved the planet Nibiru, so they said, because he had shown them where the gold was, which was they were going to powder in their environment so that the environment wouldn't escape. So that, and they had a base. Anzu was dropped off with 20 men, and he established a big transshipment base, and they used to smelt the stuff down in Bati Batira in Iraq and then transship it to Mars. It has less of an atmosphere, easier to get off, and they would just go on. It was a big base there, and then one of the perigees of Nibiru, when it came close, ripped away Mars's atmosphere and ruined Mars base, and it made the commander there lose his job and started all kinds of wars on Earth, but that's another story.
Okay, but when you look at the photographs of the Cydonia region or any of the other areas, can you identify anything that would be an Anunnaki structure, or are we assuming like...
No, many, 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 many things that I've seen on various sites, and Blowex and Closeway, it shows the same, not only is there pyramids, but there's the Black Pharaoh, and there are basically, you can see, there are lion, you know, just like the crouching lion at Giza, the same, the Sphinx. There's those kind of figures. There's pharaonic figures. Just take a look at some of the websites. Plus, we have witnesses like Andy Bashago who have been on Mars and looked around and tell us what they saw there.
Yeah. Andy was on that jump program that he speaks about. But in your book, you actually show a number of photographs of huge artifacts on the Cydonia region. We don't know. A number of researchers believe that Cydonia is a couple of 100,000 years old, or could be older. And that surface was wiped clean by some kind of a huge catastrophic event, so great that it drove the people underground, and we just don't know who these individuals are. So you're saying that you have
I'm saying that's a totally cogent explanation for what we see. What you just said makes total sense.
Okay.
Yeah, we don't know, but we're putting the pieces of the story together, and there was a passing of Nibiru that caused the great devastation on Mars and ripped off the atmosphere. So we're looking at the evidence we're finding now and correlating it with the story that was, it's not only Sitchin that deciphered this story. I mean, he did a massive amount of work during his 90 years of life, but there's other people like Kramer. So the stories are there for interpretation. You have to realize that Sitchin had the largest private collection of Sumerian cuneiforms and artifacts at that time. I don't know if whatever has happened to his collection. That's the other question. Where did that go to? But we're just piecing together the information. We can't prove anything, but you can't prove anything in the Bible either. But you just, you know, look at the information and correlate it the best we can to put together what's going on. And a picture emerges when you start piecing this information from all the different researchers. We're all contributing now. And, you know, Sitchin left, and we're all picking up the pieces. We're friends with Tellinger. We're friends with Andy Pachago and Tellinger. We're here at our house.
Sure.
They did escape together. So we're all finally saying, hey, let's figure this out. And the jury's still out. We're still getting all the evidence.
Is it your belief that a war damaged Mars, or was it a planetary event involving another planet colliding with
it
Mars?
It certainly could have been. It could have been absolutely either one of those seemed to me to be equally feasible. I have absolutely no way to determine which it was. But, you know, when we're just looking at we're looking at the stories that these guys told, and they're telling, each guy is telling their propaganda about how it was. And so I don't necessarily believe everything that the Anunnaki told the Sumerians, but I say, hey, they're really generating some interesting hypotheses about what we'll find. They're saying there's land underneath the ice in Antarctica. Well, there's no land there at all, but then when we get acoustical sounding, there was land there, and it's exactly the shape that the Anunnaki saw because they were flying above it when there wasn't ice. So that's what I mean. You can use this stuff without buying the metaphors in which it's expressed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if anybody tells you they have all 100% of the information, run the other way, because none of us do at this point. We have the powers that be, the Illuminati or whoever they are, controlling the media, controlling the message, and we have all the propaganda. So I'm sure that this was going on with the victors of war. They were, whoever won the wars or the battles lived to tell the tale, and they rewrote history the way they wanted it to be portrayed.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. Do you believe that many researchers that the story of Mars is being covered up because there are artificial man-made structures there?
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
Okay. Interesting. In chapter 5, you get into some great detail about the creation of the slaves.
Yeah.
And you show, and this is, I don't think Sitchin gets into this. This is an interesting piece of research that you present, Sasha. You show evidence that Homo erectus, which was a small ape-like creature, was the first experiment with the Anunnaki. Did you find some evidence for that, or is it just some writing that you discovered?
It's more the other way around, that it was when I examined the different accounts of the same material and I put it together, it was obvious that the Anunnaki, these tall humans like us, were adapting their genome to Earth. And it wasn't that they were making us Homo erectuses or anything like that. They were just taking enough of this Homo erectus, which was this hardy creature, the ancestor of modern Bigfoot, who was a smart, compassionate, intelligent being that was already here, but he wasn't. Basically, we are Anunnaki with some copper and some clay and some of this other stuff, and I got this from lots of sources. And however, the children that came out of this when they finally started making reproducing people, they kept breeding with them and kept breeding with them and kept breeding with them, and that's who we are. We are they. We are these Anunnaki, and we've been adapted. And Homo erectus, by my reckoning, is still here, but he is a highly intelligent a being that has his own life right here on this planet still to this day.
So have you done some research to show that the human genome is made up of an alien, has some alien DNA in it, and then it does kind of track itself to early hominins like Homo erectus?
I've read stuff that says that, but I didn't do any research directly.
Right, there's the body of Princess Gwabi that's in the London, where is it at? The London Museum, and Zechariah left several $1 million so we could do the genetic studies on that. Lloyd Pye flew over there to see if he could facilitate the process. We lost Lloyd last year to cancer. I'm always suspicious when our people get cancer, all of a sudden they're dead in a few months, so we wonder about that. Don't know what's going on with that research. That would probably give us more evidence. Every time we do any research, there's something that happens that covers it up, so it's hard for us as a community of researchers to make any progress, but we do have a lot of mysteries, and we have the cone heads, and so they are finding that people have Neanderthal genetics, we found that, well, we found stories that Bigfoot is able to reproduce with humans. So they're the same species. A species can mate and reproduce and have children. So that makes it the same species. Whilst looking at the stories of the Greys are reproducing with humans, so are they the same species? Yeah, we're looking at all this information. Dr. West wants to say something.
Yeah, and going on, the Freedom of Information Act has released things we know about the exchange program with SERPO, where we have been helped with by friendly aliens who basically saved us after losing the Battle of Wet El Sea to the last of Hitler's army. And so it's really important that we update that it's not just the Anunnaki. This planet has been visited throughout our history by many, many extraterrestrial species, and they're still involved with us to this very day. And you got to put Sitchin in this larger context. He's contributed a lot, and there's a lot more.
In the book, describe the creation of what many consider mythical creatures like minotaurs and mermaids and really strange beings. Do you attribute them to Anunnaki experimentation? I don't remember reading about that in Sitchin's books, but I find that fascinating. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's funny. I do remember reading it in several places and there's also, besides those these creatures, there's terrible ones, roaming bulls that killed people and the Egyptians tore its body to bits and cemented it in so it could never get out again. So we have lots and lots of allusions that I've read to these terrible and sometimes wonderful creatures that the geneticists Ningishita and Enki created. And it was a lot of it is in Sitchin. And where do these people get these ideas? Where does an idea come from? And the other stuff that you get if you go beyond Sitchin is that the extraterrestrials are continually experimenting with genetic combinations. The Serpo people and the stuff that got released by the government, the Kennedy's information guys, basically shows that they try all kinds of combinations and see what they get. That just seems to be genetic playing around is what other species always do.
Mm-hmm. So the creation of these creatures were purposeful, or would you say experiments gone awry?
I would say it's both. That one of the purposes in some of them, it wasn't like they went awry. But when they made a human being that couldn't urinate, or people with a deformity, and they had a lot of things. They had creatures that were in distress, and you got to look at that. It's just like people killing animals for experimentation, and it has a certain amount of cruelty in it that I can feel as I discuss it with you. And so, yeah, they had misfits. They had terrible mistakes, and they had some stuff that was really fun for them, too.
They
probably created creatures for different purposes, like the story of Gilgamesh. They have a being that guarded, a certain tunnel so people couldn't get through. So, like we have dogs and stuff that are used as guards. They created these beings that would act as guards or watch beings that would alert, other Anunnaki that somebody was trying to encroach on their on their region.
So they made a variety of creatures purposefully to do various labor-intensive things. But you know
what, Cliff? I got to say, there's one other thing I really got to say. They made mechanical things too. They made mechanical.
Oh, like what?
Like a mechanical bull that was guarding the entrance to the landing platform at when Gilgamesh was trying to get there, and the bull attacked him and attacked Enkidu, and they tore it apart. And much to their surprise, all kinds of gears and stuff fell out.
Also, Enkidu apparently was an android. Enkidu was created by Enki for Gilgamesh, for a companion for Gilgamesh, and he was an android. He wasn't quite 100% human, but they used human DNA. Somehow they constructed him, but he was not, 100% human. He was an android.
Yeah, but then it's the story of Data, really.
Yeah, it's Data.
Data 40. So how long ago was it that they were creating these androids, these mechanical beings, and this hybridization of Anunnaki and Earth beings?
Okay, so the first big one was when they made Adamu, Adam, and Tiamat, the first girl, and that was the first breedable pair. Ningishita or Toth discovered how to make them breedable, and these kids were just amazing. And she got pregnant by him, and she had a Satori, an enlightenment experience, and she was Enki and his wife brought them up to his place, which was next door to the commander's place. And when the commander came over, he saw that she was pregnant. Little Tiamat said, "Hi, I'm Tiamat. Look what I made. Oh, who are you?" And the commander was so angry because he didn't allow the scientist to make breedables. He said, "Get these things out of here." Well, this was the original ones, and they let them breed. Their first two kids. That went on. But then, that was 300,000 years ago. 200,000 years ago, Enki decided he was getting pressure from the boss to have better and smarter slaves. They'd work harder and not eat so many rations and wouldn't wander off into the bush when times got tough. And so Enki had the idea that he would do it. He got the prettiest girls he could find. He got two of them, got them both pregnant. And their kids, these are the really important ones, were called Adapa and Titi. And Adapa and Titi mated, and their first kids were Cain and Abel, and the story goes on.
So let's talk about the hybrid girl, Tiamat. She was blonde. She was white, which I guess is Caucasian. And she was a blue-eyed girl, so she must have had a lot of the Anunnaki's DNA in her. What do we have any images of her that are referred to in history books?
I had no images, but the verbals, I've never seen an image, but what they said was that, furthermore, she came from the womb of Damkina. So besides whoever her, besides everything else, she was also carried by this beautiful blonde woman who was the daughter of the ex-king of Nibiru. And these are educated people, and they doted on these kids, and they gave them all their energy. And Adapa was a genius. These Adapa and Titi's children were these bright, bright kids, Cain and Abel, and each of the factions adopted one of them, the herdsman or the farmer. And the Bible pretty well covers the story after that, and it's adapting many thousands of years later to the way they wanted to run the story. But it's really about two brothers, and they're fighting over how to run Earth. To which they had come to get gold to send back to their home planet and save it, so they said.
Okay. You said that Tiamat was pregnant when she was introduced to the head man on Earth. Were there any well-known descendants from her?
I don't know of any well-known descendants from her until 100,000 years later, according to the way Sitchin puts it. Basically, they bred, and their kids bred, and their kids bred, and they were. Then the gold was coming from South African mines and coming up the Persian Gulf and being shipped from Iraq on up to Mars. And everything was
was going really good, and then times started getting bad, and the slaves started wandering off, and they didn't want to work for them in the mines, and they just got their own food. They didn't need the, who needs these gods? They're not taking good care of us anyway. And that's when Anki got the pressure to improve the lot. And so that's when we get the descendants. What they say is two beautiful girls, and they go into the great detail about the sex they have, and they have a baby. They have kids. They have TT and Adapa, and these are incredible beings. The king of Nibiru is so impressed by Adapa, has him shipped to Nibiru, and they say, we got to be careful of these creatures. There's millions of them, and there's only a few of us down on Earth, and besides, Marduk may well organize them to try to claim the crown here on Nibiru, and I don't want these creatures to be able to live as long as we live, and you can rule. Anyway, it goes on and on. The story goes on.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's really interesting. You referred to the gold mining in Africa. Is that really the only place that we see the Anunnaki digging for gold? There's evidence of very, very old mines in North America. There's evidence of mines in parts of Europe. Do we know of other areas that the Anunnaki
right
dug?
Absolutely. Everything you're saying is totally accurate. Every place, but especially in the Andes, I mean, just the kind of... they got placer gold, and they shipped it out of Tiwanaku and great big runway lines in Nazca Plains, and they also got tin ready to use when the Bronze Age was clamoring for it over in the other in the Middle East, cassiterite, yeah, and yes, there was gold mines everywhere, and everywhere they have they had a worldwide grid of pyramids, which were along the fault lines of the Earth, where electromagnetic energy can be stir the waters and be pumped up as energy. And if you meditate in those places, which was what they had people do, it changes all their molecules too, and you can tune them in. That's one of the purposes. They were multi-purpose pyramids. They were used for gold extraction, energy generation, and for getting into a spiritual space.
Mm-hmm. Do you believe that the human today has a untapped portion of their physicality that is Anunnaki that we don't know about? That you've maybe have experienced, as an example, the ancients tell us that meditation is very beneficial for the brain and for well-being, but the majority of people on the planet don't do that, and especially in the Western world where time is of essence and we're all trying to make money and material goods are the way of life. Meditation is not even thought about. But would you say, as a researcher, that there's some untapped part of humanity that the Anunnaki provided us that we need to know more about? And if it is, what is it?
Well, I think I totally agree with everything you said. That's exactly how I see things. And what they left for us was a series of structures that facilitate meditation. And if you go to a sacred site, or even if you just think of a sacred site, and you let yourself tune into the vibrations of the earth, and especially if you're near water, and let the water molecules, which is mostly what you are, vibrate through you, you can access the spiritual dimensions. And there's many, many ways of having meditative states, but meditating yourself, meditating with others in a sacred place with an intention
of being able to connect with higher, more compassionate realms of consciousness works. And it was left there by our Anunnaki ancestors so that when we were ready, we could understand that we are one, that we are lovingly connected with everybody here on this planet and with everything in the universe, and stop killing each other.
The Anunnaki introduced Tantra to the Earth, and they had a spiritual connection too. They called it the being the creator of all. So the Anunnaki worshipped, I don't like the word worship, but they recognized the creator of all as being a higher power and someone that they emulated and looked up to. They also referenced that they were part of a federation, that they had interplanetary rules of conduct that they were violating by creating human beings. So they had to deal with that conflict within the themselves because they created the slave race. They also referenced a being called Galzu, G-A-L-Z-U, who apparently they thought was a emissary from the creator of all. So that's some of the things I'd like to just clear up a little bit.
Okay. So this is for either one of you. Do you think there is something that that you sense as being untapped in the human being of today who is on Earth, who are descendants of these beings that we are not using or are not accessing?
Most definitely. We have 256 strands of DNA that have been turned off. We have a friend, Dr. Aubrey de Grey, who has the Methuselah Project, and they're researching the physical immortality. Now, Dr. de Grey does not really understand the Anunnaki information, but he's been a guest at our home, and we've had some workshops on his Human Genome Project that he's been decoding. And so he approaches from a different perspective. But we have the capability of living hundreds of thousands of years, basically being physically immortal. That's what he's discovered in his scientific approach. And then we correlate that with the Anunnaki's information. And then we tie that in with the spirituality aspects. It's possible that they could do things within their own being as telepathic communication, and maybe they could transport things with their mind. We're not sure exactly what all their capabilities are, but I am an experiencer. So I have personally experienced telepathic communication with extraterrestrials. And it's not, they're speaking words in your head. It's concepts. And I've been in a place where there were 1,000 beings talking at once. Think of a beehive, and yet everybody could understand each other. So there's, reflecting on my experiences, and I go, how could I even begin to understand that? That must be something that was in my own being that was activated in order for me to be able to comprehend 1,000 people simultaneously communicating like the bees in a hive. So I just have an inkling of some of these capabilities that we're learning from other experiencers. There's over a million experiencers that they've figured out based on the surveys and doing a selective, survey, pulling of the population. Mm-hmm. And they're getting the figure at millions have had experiences. Now, we're encouraging people to come out and talk about it, stop judging themselves. And if you can't talk about it using your real name, just come to us and tell us your stories, because these are vital pieces of the puzzle that we need in order to get total picture so we can free all of us from this evil, perverted matrix that is upon us and leading our reality.
Okay. So is it possible that Anunnaki wrote a death gene program, and we have a gene in our system that begins to age us to the point where our systems shut down after a certain time factor? Or is there techniques that you believe that can be instituted that begin to help us live into a longer life, into our, people today live into their 90s, but people under their hundreds are extremely rare.
Wow, but both your the answer is yes to both parts of those. Yeah, they basically deliberately, in the at least what the Sumerians say the gods told them, is they decided not to let us be too long lived because they were afraid of our greater numbers, and they could see how very smart Adapa scared them. This was a genius human being. It blew their minds. They could see that he was, and so they were frightened at what Enki had created, this vigorous, intelligent being.
Yeah, they could only, they weren't able to reproduce like apparently they once did, so it was hard for them to create full-blooded children. They had lost hybrid vigor, is what we call it. And so they were creating hybrids. So it's much like the story of the Greys. The Greys are saying they need humanity in order to survive as a species. I think upon reflection, they realized, especially after the devastation of Noah's flood, that they really needed us as much as we needed them. And so we are in this symbiotic relationship of sorts. Okay, I wanted to reflect further on the genetics. Yes, they did turn us off genetically. We've got all this turned off DNA. Anyway, I forgot what I was going to say, but I agree with that, that we've been shortened, and that's why Dr. Aubrey de Grey is finding that it can be reversed, and he had predicted it would be 10 to 20 years out, but I just tuned into his research, and apparently they already have this information. Now, will the Illuminati powers that be let that come out? Touch with
well, just in the ultra-highest, you know, basically... The Zaya Sutra is very clearly saying to Gilgamesh, "Yeah, we can live forever because we eat this stuff, this plant, and it lets us live as long as we keep eating it." And they are repeatedly when the higher power told the leaders on Earth, "You can't go back to Nibiru or you'll die of because you've been on Earth too long and you're aging." And the king finally said, that's nonsense. I never said anything like that. We have ways of curing aging. You don't have to age. So we've got, in their propaganda of the stories they left us anyway, we've got all these stories that they have technically got it. And we know very well that Valiant Thor offered just such a thing. And Eisenhower turned it down because he wanted military secrets. And the Venusians were not going to. Do give us any more military stuff, and well, Janet can tell you more about that.
Well, yeah. Anyway, I don't know where to go. Back to you, Cliff.